September 1st, 1974. Jackson County, Oregon. 28-year-old Richard Cowden, his 22-year-old wife Belinda Cowden, and their two children, 5-year-old David and 5-month-old Melissa, are in the midst of a camping trip near Carberry Creek when they suddenly vanish from their campsite, leaving all their possessions behind. 7 months later, the entire family's remains are found at a remote location 7 miles away, and it turns out they were the victims of foul play. A local resident named Dwayne Lee Little pops up on the radar as a suspect and eventually goes to prison for another crime, but without any hard evidence to implicate him, the Cowden family murders remain unsolved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and since we just passed our third anniversary, this episode will officially kick off year 4 of our podcast, and unfortunately, it's one of the most disturbing cases we've ever covered, the Cowden family murders. It involves the disappearance and subsequent death of a couple named Richard and Belinda Cowden, as well as their two children. The entire family was abducted and murdered by an unknown perpetrator while they were on a Labor Day weekend camping trip, and it would be months before the remains were discovered. This case was actually suggested to me over a year ago by a listener named Abby, and I confess that I had never actually heard of this story before. 1 year after this crime happened, legendary true crime writer Ann Rule wrote a column about it in the New York Daily News, and would later devote a chapter to the case in her book, But I Trusted You. Once I started delving into the case, I found it to be one of the most frightening and senseless crimes I've ever researched, and I can't imagine what the motive might have been, particularly since it involved the murder of two children, one of them a 5-month-old infant. Investigators have pointed the finger at a primary suspect, Dwayne Lee Little, who is currently incarcerated for another crime, so we're going to explore the likelihood of him being the perpetrator on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the Cowden family murders. Our story begins in Oregon in 1974. One of our central figures is 28-year-old Richard Cowden, who lives with his family in the small community of White City, located in Jackson County. Richard makes his living as a logging truck driver in order to support his 22-year-old wife Belinda and their two children, 5-year-old David, Belinda's son from a previous relationship whom Richard legally adopted, and their 5-month-old infant daughter Melissa. Richard was planning to spend Labor Day weekend hauling a load of gravel from his driveway and made arrangements to borrow a truck from his boss to do the job, but it unexpectedly broke down. So Richard made the last-minute decision to take his family on a camping trip instead. On Friday, August the 30th, the Cowdens left their home in their 1956 Ford pickup truck and drove over 40 miles to a campground near Carberry Creek, located in the Siskiyou Mountains. They also brought along their pet dog, a basset hound named Droopy. The family had camped in the area before, and had one particular spot they liked, so after parking their truck on Carberry Creek Road, they walked down a bank and set up camp at a site next to the creek. They camped 2 nights there, and Richard and David spent much of the weekend fishing together, before they decided to take Droopy and hike a mile to the nearby community of Copper on the morning of Sunday, September the 1st. Copper was located only 1 mile north of the California-Oregon border, and the Cowdens arrived at the local general store at approximately 9 a.m. Richard purchased a quart of milk and left the store alongside his son and their dog, but this would turn out to be the last time anyone from the family was seen alive. Belinda's mother, Ruth Grayson, happened to live in Copper, and the plan was for the Cowdens to stop by her home for dinner that night before they drove back to White River. However, the family never showed up, so Ruth became concerned, but was surprised to discover that it was completely deserted. Even though the pickup truck and all of the family's personal belongings were still there, there was no sign of any of them, and even their dog Droopy was missing. The keys to the truck and Belinda's purse were found on the picnic table, along with the bottle of milk Richard had purchased earlier that morning, which was now half full. A fully assembled camp stove was nearby with dishes and utensils resting next to it, and a plastic dishpan filled with cold water was on the ground. Other items which were left behind included a diaper bag, an open pack of cigarettes, which was the same brand Belinda smoked, a relatively expensive wristwatch Richard owned, and his wallet, which still contained $23. Folded clothing was found on top of a cot and inside the pickup truck, and since the only items which could not be accounted for were the family's bathing suits, this seemed to indicate that they had gone swimming in the creek right before they vanished. Since there were no signs of a struggle or that any violence had taken place, Ruth was not immediately alarmed, but after waiting for an hour for the family to show up, she left the campsite to report their disappearance to the Jackson County Sheriff's Office. They began a search of the area, but it soon became so dark that they could not see anything. Early the next morning, Droopy finally turned up when he was found scratching the door of the Copper General Store. He was unharmed, but looked exhausted and upset. Multiple campers would later report having seen Droopy walking along the creek the previous day at around 2:30 and 6:30 p.m., respectively, approximately 4 to 6 miles upstream from the Cowdens' campsite. Anyway, the Jackson County Sheriff's Office eventually notified the Oregon State Police, and this would become one of the largest search efforts in the history of the state. Once word of the Cowden family's disappearance spread, numerous volunteers, along with the Explorer Scouts, the United States Forest Service, and the Oregon National Guard, would assist law enforcement with the search. Helicopters and planes were flown over the area using infrared photography, but no trace of anyone from the family could be found. Given the evidence at the campsite, investigators suspected that the Cowdens had gone swimming shortly after Richard and David returned from the general store and were sitting down for lunch when they were abducted from the scene. Police interviewed over 150 people, many of whom had been in the campground on the day the Cowdens went missing. A local farmer told investigators that he had spoken to a couple from Los Angeles who shared a story about having arrived at the campground that same afternoon with their three children, but they saw two men and a woman in a pickup truck who made them nervous. As a result, a public appeal was sent out for this couple to come forward. A petition was drawn up in order to request assistance from the FBI, but there were some jurisdictional issues. Even though the Cowdens' campsite was only a mile away from the Oregon-California border, there was no definitive evidence that anyone from the family had been kidnapped and taken across state lines, so the FBI could not become involved in the investigation. The ordeal would have a traumatic impact on Richard Cowden's family. Richard had a sister and two brothers, the eldest of whom died of cancer at age 25. In a cruel twist of fate, the surviving brother, Wes, had been released from the hospital right before Labor Day weekend after surgery revealed that a tumor he feared might be malignant turned out to be benign. But Wes's relief was short-lived once he learned that Richard had gone missing. Their father, Robert Cowden, became so despondent over the disappearances that he committed suicide in December. In spite of this turn of events, police cleared Robert as a suspect. The Cowdens remained missing persons for 7 months until there would finally be some answers. On April 12, 1975, a pair of gold prospectors were hiking through the woods near Carberry Creek when they came across some human remains. The skeleton of a male victim was discovered to be tied to a tree on a steep rocky hillside, and animals had scattered many of his bones all over the area. The police were soon summoned to the scene, and the following day, they checked out a shallow cave located 200 yards away. It appeared that the cave's entrance had been sealed by rocks, but the winter weather had caused a rock slide and created an opening. When police looked inside, they discovered more human remains, which appeared to belong to a female and two children, one of whom was an infant. It became apparent that this was the missing Cowden family, and they were soon positively identified via dental records. The location where they were discovered was 7 miles west from their campsite, and it was suspected that a vehicle had been used to transport them to this location. Authorities believed that Richard had died there, but due to the conditions of his remains, they were unable to determine the exact cause of death. Belinda and David had both been shot in the head with a .22 caliber rifle, while Melissa died from severe head trauma. Investigators briefly looked into the possibility that Richard had committed a murder-suicide, but since an extensive search of the area turned up no trace of a gun, this possibility was ruled out. It was unclear if Belinda and the two children were actually killed at the location they were found, or if they may have been murdered elsewhere before their bodies were brought back to the scene and concealed inside the cave. One volunteer who participated in the search party claimed that he had already looked in the cave in early September, shortly after the Cowdens went missing, and the bodies were not there at that time. Police wondered if perhaps the volunteer was mistaken about which cave he searched, so they asked him to escort them there, and he wound up bringing them to the exact same cave. Investigators suspected that the perpetrator may have been a local resident who had knowledge of the area and was aware of this cave's existence. Months after the discovery of the remains, the aforementioned couple from Los Angeles were finally tracked down. They confirmed the farmer's story, claiming that they arrived at the campground with their children at around 5 p.m. on September 1st, the same afternoon the Cowdens went missing. They stopped at a particular spot and recalled seeing two men and a woman parking a pickup truck nearby. The family got the impression that the people in the truck were waiting for them to leave, and this made them nervous enough that they decided to walk away and find another spot. This location was about halfway between the Cowdens' campsite and where the remains were ultimately found. Well, investigators would eventually zero in on a promising suspect in the murders. Within a week of the Cowdens' disappearances, police received a report from the Oregon State Board of Parole, who informed them about a recent parolee living in Jackson County, 25-year-old Dwayne Lee Little. Little had a very unusual and difficult childhood. At the age of 7, he was accidentally hit on the head with a baseball bat, which left him with a severe depression in his skull. He was forced to wear a protective helmet for 5 months, and the injury gave him frequent issues with headaches and learning difficulties. In November of 1964, when he was only 15 and living in Springfield, Oregon, Little was arrested for the murder of a 16-year-old neighbor of his named Orla Faye Phipps. He had stabbed her multiple times, slit her throat, and fractured her skull with a blunt instrument before proceeding to rape her body after she was already dead. When Little was convicted of first-degree murder over a year later, he received a life sentence at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem, making him the youngest person to ever get sent there. However, there was some controversy about the sentence, because even though he was technically still 15 years old at the time he committed the murder, Little turned 16 1 month after he was indicted for the crime, so he was remanded from juvenile court to adult court to face his murder charge. So when Little arrived at the state penitentiary, many of the staff and older inmates looked out for him, and after being a model prisoner for years, a lot of people genuinely seemed to believe that Little had been rehabilitated. As a result, he was able to obtain parole in May of 1974. After his release, he moved to Jackson County in order to live with his parents, Bruce and Margaret Little, in the small community of Rooch, located just over 20 miles away from the campsite where the Cowdens went missing from. Well, Little and his parents were questioned and denied any involvement in the murders. Little claimed that on August 31st, the day before the Cowdens went missing, he had driven to Crescent City, California in his family's pickup truck to drop off some metal and spent the night there sleeping in the truck. He then returned home and met up with his parents for a trip into the mountains the following day. But what struck investigators as odd is that Little specifically denied being in Copper at all on September 1st, even though the road which provided him with the quickest route from Crescent City back to his home in Rooch would have taken him straight through Copper. On September 2nd, Little and his parents visited a cabin along the Sturgis Fork Trail, located only a couple miles away from the Cowdens' campsite. The cabin's owner even provided a guest book to show that the Littles had signed their names. The Littles' home was searched, and their pickup truck impounded, but even though no evidence could be found to implicate them, investigators were struck by how clean the truck was. At the time, the family from Los Angeles had not yet been located, but their description of the pickup truck containing the two men and a woman was very similar to the Littles' truck. It wasn't long before Dwayne Lee Little ran into some legal problems. Shortly after Christmas time, Little's girlfriend contacted the police to inform them that she had seen him with a .22 caliber rifle and they had once used it for target shooting together. The conditions of Little's parole forbid him to have access to any firearms, and his girlfriend's decision to come forward seemed to be motivated by the fact that she had found out he was cheating on her with another woman. But since Belinda and David Cowden had been shot with a .22 caliber rifle, this lead was an intriguing one. Even though investigators were unable to locate this rifle, they told Little they would drop any potential weapons charges if he agreed to take a lie detector test in regards to the Cowden family's disappearances. Well, Little refused, so he wound up having his parole revoked on January 12, 1975. Instead, he elected to plead guilty to the weapons charge, wound up receiving a new 5-year sentence, and went back to prison. By the time the Cowdens' remains were discovered in April, Little was the only suspect who law enforcement had not completely eliminated. But this would not be the end of the story with him. Little was paroled again in September of 1977 and moved to Portland. On June 23, 1980, a recently pregnant 23-year-old woman from Tigard had her car break down in the interstate near Portland. A male motorist pulled over and offered to give her a ride, but after she got into his vehicle, he proceeded to drive to an isolated area where he sexually assaulted the woman before choking her and stabbing her several times with a switchblade. The victim was left for dead, but after the perpetrator was gone, she managed to crawl to a nearby road and flag down a car for help. In spite of losing 1/3 of the blood in her body, the woman and her unborn child wound up surviving the attack. She soon identified the perpetrator as Dwayne Lee Little, and he was quickly picked up and charged with attempted homicide. Ironically, the attack had taken place only 5 weeks after Little's wife gave birth to their first child. Little was found guilty at trial and received 3 consecutive 20-year sentences for rape, attempted murder, and kidnapping. Only a few months after Little was charged with the crime, Floyd Forsberg, an inmate who shared a cell with him, came forward to claim that he heard Little confess to the Cowden family murders. Jackson County prosecutors were prepared to seek grand jury indictments against Little, but the case fell apart once investigators determined that Forsberg was an unreliable witness. Forsberg had a history of fabricating stories, and some of the details he provided about Little's alleged confession did not match the facts of the case. Other inmates who knew Little described him as someone who would never talk about his crimes, so there was a lot of skepticism about Forsberg's claims that Little had admitted to murdering the Cowdens. So even though there was a compelling circumstantial case against Little, there was just not enough evidence to charge him with the crime. At the time of this recording, Little is 70 years old and is still incarcerated at the Oregon State Penitentiary, while the Cowden family murders officially remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Now, before I talk about anything else, I have to share this quote from the article Ann Rule wrote about the case in the New York Daily News in November of 1975. She starts off the article by describing this old-timer standing outside a general store in White City, Oregon, who shares the story about the Cowden family with a tourist and says, quote, "Nobody knows what happened to him, but some say a spaceship got him, picked him up, and took him off. We had the first flying saucers out here way back in the 40s. Maybe we got the first space kidnapping. Lord, I don't know. You tell me how a whole family disappears like that if it wasn't something weird." End quote. Well, I think it's safe to say that the Cowdens were not abducted by aliens, but this is still a very creepy story. I cannot imagine how eerie it would have been for Belinda's mother, Ruth Grayson, to show up at their campsite right before nighttime and discover that the entire family was missing and everything they owned, aside from their bathing suits, was left behind. This showed that there was no way the family could have disappeared voluntarily, and you automatically had to assume the worst right from the outset. One quote which is often associated with this case came from a state trooper who visited their abandoned campsite and said, quote, "It was spooky, even the milk was still on the table." If there wasn't a very promising prime suspect in the family's murders, I'm not sure what people would think of this case. Incidentally, since we're on the subject of Ann Rule, you're probably aware that she is best known for her book about Ted Bundy, The Stranger Beside Me. Since the recent release of the Netflix documentary series, The Ted Bundy Tapes, has put him back into the spotlight again, I thought it was worth mentioning that Bundy has a very minor connection to this case. In 1974, there was an epidemic of unsolved disappearances in the Pacific Northwest. In the months before the Cowdens vanished, no less than 8 young women had gone missing in Oregon and Washington State, and since Belinda was around the same age as them, investigators looked into the possibility that there might be a connection. Of course, it eventually turned out most of those other missing women were victims of Ted Bundy. Now, no one has ever suspected Bundy of being involved in this particular crime, as the consensus from law enforcement seems to be that Dwayne Lee Little is the most likely candidate. We know that Little was definitely capable of heinous crimes, as he raped and murdered one woman, and raped and nearly murdered a second victim, but this case is a whole other level of evil, since it involves the murder of 2 young children, one of whom was only 5 months old. However, if Belinda Cowden happened to catch Little's eye, and he wanted to have his way with her, he may have been willing to kill anyone who got in his way, even if they were children. This seems to be another one of those unfortunate stories where the victims wound up in the wrong place at the wrong time because of a cruel twist of fate. As you'll recall, Richard Cowden had planned to spend Labor Day weekend hauling gravel, and if the truck he needed to borrow hadn't broken down, the family never would have gone camping to begin with. It's estimated that the Cowdens disappeared from their campsite sometime around noon on September 1st. The last confirmed sighting was when Richard and David showed up at the general store to buy milk that morning, and they were noticed to be missing when they did not show up for dinner at Ruth Grayson's house that night. There was some speculation that perhaps the perpetrator targeted Belinda while Richard and David were at the store because he noticed she was alone at the campsite. However, the evidence clearly shows that Richard and David made it back there before anything happened, as it seems like the family was in the midst of preparing lunch. Since the only clothing which was unaccounted for was their swimsuits, they had probably gotten changed to go swimming, or were preparing to swim in the creek, before they were suddenly attacked. The fact that their remains were discovered at a location 7 miles away would indicate that they were abducted and brought there in a vehicle. Since there were no signs of any violence or foul play at the campsite, the Cowdens were probably not killed there, but there has been some question about whether they were actually killed at the location they were found. Strangely enough, after my anniversary show last week about the disappearance of the Springfield 3, this is the second consecutive episode I presented where the only living witness was a dog who probably saw everything that happened. Now, I know most of you out there are animal lovers, and we're probably relieved to hear that Droopy the Basset Hound survived this ordeal, but I do think there's something creepy about a murderer who would spare a dog, but have no qualms about killing a 5-month-old baby. We know the killer had a gun, since some of the victims were shot, but I'm guessing that Droopy didn't put up too much resistance, because otherwise, the killer could have shot him too. We have multiple witnesses who recalled seeing Droopy walking along the creek miles away from the campsite between 2:30 and 6:30 p.m. I have a feeling that Droopy witnessed his family get abducted in a vehicle and tried to follow them on foot, but eventually lost them. He then spent most of the day and night searching for the family, but when he could not find them, he made his way back and eventually wound up at the general store, which he would have been familiar with since he went there alongside Richard and David the previous morning. Now, like I just mentioned, there is some confusion about where the family might have been killed. Since some of Richard's remains were tied to a tree, authorities believe he was murdered at that spot, but they cannot be certain if Belinda and the 2 children were killed there, or if their remains were brought to the location and stuffed inside the cave at a later time. As you recall, one of the volunteers claimed that he searched the cave shortly after the Cowdens went missing, and there was nothing in there at that time. It seems like he was able to convince police that he did not get mixed up about which cave it was, but here's the strange part. If he was in that area in early September, why didn't he notice Richard tied to the tree? I know that a lot of his bones were scattered by animals by the time he was found, but I'm not sure Richard's body would have been skeletal in September, and it may have produced a noticeable stench. So does this mean that Richard's body was also at another location at that time? What's even stranger is that after hiding Belinda, David, and Melissa's remains, the killer went to the trouble of using rocks to seal the entrance to the cave, but why go to the trouble of doing that when Richard's remains are left right out there in the open, tied to a tree? I do have to wonder if Belinda and the kids were taken to another location after Richard was murdered. The killer may have originally disposed of the remains elsewhere, but for whatever reason, got paranoid that a potential discovery could be traced back to him, so he decided to move them to the cave. It's possible the perpetrator did have some initial misgivings about murdering children, which is why they were taken to another location while he figured out what to do. But in the end, he ultimately decided to leave no living witnesses. If Dwayne Lee Little did this, I wonder if there's any significance to the fact that his parole was revoked and he was sent back to prison in January. It's been suspected that his parents were involved in the crime, so perhaps his arrest motivated them to transfer the remains into the cave. Anyway, we now have to talk about Little, because really, he is the only major suspect the investigation ever turned up. So discussing theories about what happened to the Cowdens will revolve entirely around whether he did it or not. However, you could probably do an entire podcast episode devoted to the Little family, because their backstory is so bizarre. It's not so absurd to believe that Dwayne's parents, Bruce and Margaret Little, helped him cover up the crime, because they are pretty strange folks. During Dwayne's childhood, Bruce essentially forced the family to live in seclusion because he was paranoid that his brother Lee was planning to kill him. This came about after Bruce was shot in the groin, causing him to lose a testicle, part of his penis, and partial use of his right leg. While the official story was that one of Bruce's foster children had shot him by accident, some suspected it was his brother who actually did it. Apparently, Lee was lusting after Bruce's stepdaughter, who had been conceived after Margaret had a relationship with another man. Bruce also believed that another man was planning to murder him so that he could move in on Margaret. During 1 5-year period, Bruce claimed that 2 of his dogs were poisoned, 9 of his cows were poisoned or shot, a bunch of mysterious fires destroyed their home and logging equipment, and Bruce was left crippled when a tree fell on him, which he believed was done deliberately by the man who was lusting after his wife. Things finally came to a boil in 1961 when Bruce was arrested for shooting his brother Lee, though he claimed it was self-defense. Bruce was found not guilty by reason of insanity and committed to a mental hospital near Spokane, Washington. 2 years later, Bruce simply walked away from the hospital, and while he was apprehended in Memphis, there were apparently issues with extraditing him back to Washington State, so they pretty much just let him go, and Bruce wound up reuniting with his family and moving to Oregon. In a weird postscript to this story, Bruce would suddenly be arrested for his escape from the mental hospital in 1988, 25 years after it originally happened, and the family felt that Bruce was being unfairly targeted because his son was now a convicted murderer. I think the point I'm trying to make is that even if Dwayne did something as heinous as murder an entire family, I think his parents would have been willing to protect him. When Dwayne was charged with Orla Faye Phipps' murder back in 1964 and went on trial, Bruce told his son that if he admitted that he was guilty of the crime, he would help him escape and ensure he would never be found. And Margaret, who is known for being an overprotective mother who smothered Dwayne, said that she would never believe any of the evidence against her quote-unquote perfect boy unless he confessed that he actually did it. Now, we have this eyewitness sighting by a couple from Los Angeles who were in the same campground on the same afternoon the Cowdens went missing, who claimed they saw 2 men and a woman inside a pickup truck, which matched the description of the truck the Littles owned at that time. When the Littles' truck was searched, Police pretty much described it as one of the most spotless trucks they'd ever seen, and believed that it had recently been given a very thorough cleaning job. So when you look at the timeline, it's very easy to suspect that Dwayne, Bruce, and Margaret were the three individuals seen in that pickup truck, especially since the witnesses thought it looked like they were waiting for them to leave. So could they have been in the midst of disposing evidence or moving the Cowden family's bodies? Well, no matter how much parents might love their child, most of them would probably draw the line at helping them if it turned out they murdered a 5-year-old boy and a 5-month-old infant. But as I've shared with you, Bruce and Margaret Little were most definitely not normal parents. Now, I know there was controversy over the fact that Dwayne originally received a life sentence for the murder of Orla Faye Phipps, but served less than 10 years before he was paroled. And then less than 4 months later, the Cowdens were murdered. When Little was sent back to prison for attempted homicide in 1980, the victim actually filed a $1 million lawsuit against the Oregon State Board of Parole, not only for letting him out in 1974, but for doing so again 3 years later when he went back for a parole violation. You could definitely say the world would be a much better place if Little had remained in prison following his initial murder conviction in 1964, but I can understand the circumstances of how he was let out. He entered the Oregon State Penitentiary at the age of 17, but it sounds like most of the people there really looked out for him, and that he did a very successful job of convincing everyone that he was a changed man and deserved a second chance. But sadly, things didn't work out as everyone had hoped. Now, the circumstances of how Little's parole was revoked in January of 1975 are a little strange. He went back to prison for possessing a firearm, which his girlfriend said was a .22 caliber rifle. But the issue is that the authorities never actually found this rifle, and only took her word that he had been using one. I'm not saying she was lying, but she obviously had ulterior motives to get revenge once she found out Little had been cheating on her. I mean, the idea that you can have your parole revoked simply because someone told the police you did something illegal when there's no corroborating evidence, that is pretty troubling. However, they did tell Little that they would make this weapons charge go away if he agreed to take a polygraph test and answer questions about the Cowdens, but instead, he chose to turn them down and go back to prison, which is pretty damning as far as I'm concerned. I mean, even if Little failed the polygraph, the results are not admissible, so it's not like he would have been charged with the murders without additional evidence, especially since no bodies had been found yet. But it sounds like he was willing to trade off a few additional years in prison in order to avoid the risk of possibly being implicated in a much more serious crime. You have to remember that at the time Little's parole was revoked, the Cowdens were still missing persons, and investigators did not yet know that Belinda and David had been shot with a .22 caliber rifle, which added much more significance to the allegation that Little owned the same type of rifle which had now gone missing. Honestly, I think I would have preferred it if Little had not been sent back to prison, because if he had been free at the time the Cowdens' remains were discovered, investigators could have watched over Little or re-interviewed him just to see how he reacted, and he might have done something to incriminate himself. It would have been especially interesting to see Little's reaction after they tracked down the couple who saw the two men and a woman inside a pickup truck, because this potentially implicated his parents in the crime. Anyway, when you look at the big picture, I really can't think of any other conclusion other than Little being the killer. The location where the Cowdens disappeared from is very remote, and it would be quite a coincidence if a recently paroled murderer who lived only 20 miles away and later went back to prison for another violent crime wasn't the perpetrator. At this point, there's certainly not enough direct evidence to charge Little with the murders, but there is a decent amount of circumstantial evidence. I always found it interesting how Little made it a point to deny that he was in Copper on the day of the crime, even though his route from Crescent City to his home in Rooch would have taken him through there. I'm thinking that Little just happened to be driving through the area that day on his way home from California when he passed by the Cowdens' campsite on Carberry Creek Road and set his eyes on Belinda. Since her remains were skeletal, we have no idea if Belinda was sexually assaulted, but given the brutal nature of Little's other crimes and the fact that he raped his first victim after she was already dead, I'd say that was his likely motive. But this time, he was willing to murder his victim's husband and 2 children to get what he wanted. Since everything was left behind at the campsite, including some money and an expensive wristwatch Richard owned, this crime was definitely not driven by robbery. Little probably abducted the entire family at gunpoint, and though it would have been difficult for one man to control four people, if Little threatened the children's lives, then I'm sure he could have convinced their parents to do whatever he wanted. Since Richard's remains were found tied to a tree, it's just horrifying to think that Little may have forced Richard to watch him murder his wife and two children. I don't think Little's parents were directly involved in the murders, but I'm sure they protected him, and were in the midst of helping him cover up the crime when they were seen in the pickup truck together that afternoon. The silver lining is that Little eventually went back to prison, and there's virtually no chance he'll ever be paroled or set free to hurt anyone again. But it would still be nice to have conclusive evidence to prove he committed these murders, so they could close the books on this case once and for all. I know we have one of Little's cellmates, Floyd Forsberg, claim he heard Little confess to the crime, but I'm sure I don't have to tell you that jailhouse informants are very unreliable, and Forsberg seems like a pretty strange guy in his own right. At the time, Forsberg was already serving a life sentence for another murder, and he had a tendency to come forward with fabricated stories, such as one occasion where he falsely confessed to being responsible for a murder that someone else had been convicted for. So I have my doubts that Forsberg is telling the truth about Little's confession, because if there's one thing which always seemed consistent about Little, it's that he never liked to talk about his crimes or admit what he did. If Little will never openly take responsibility for the Cowden family murders, all that can really be done is uncover other evidence implicating him in the crime, which will be difficult to do after nearly 45 years. However, if by chance you happen to have any information on the unsolved murders of Richard, Belinda, David, and Melissa Cowden, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already produced some exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this month, to commemorate our podcast passing its third anniversary, I've released a bonus episode in which I discuss my personal top 10 favorite episodes of The Trail Went Cold and provide some exclusive behind-the-scenes info about how these episodes came about. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up to support us on Patreon this week, Sean G. and A. Thank you so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.